Blog Talk Radio.
This is Graham Hancock. You're listening to Earth Ancients with Cliff Dunning.
Saturday, September the 2nd, 2017. This is Earth Ancients. I'm your host, Cliff Dunning. Hey, we're into September. Those of you who live in California, hey, specifically Northern California, we're frying. We're cooking here. We've had record heat. And for those of us living up here, we're not used to it. You know, it was 106 degrees in San Francisco yesterday. That's heat that is, you know, we're not used to this. And people are freaking out. I have friends that live in Sacramento. It was 110 there, just very close to here by about 5 or 6 miles in Livermore, which is now a very well-known wine region. It was 116 degrees. Now, that's strange heat for us here. I mean, some of you that live in other parts of the South, even on the East Coast, occasionally get heat in the triple digits, but not here in Northern California, and we're not used to it. So it's tough for us because a lot of homes do not have air conditioning. People are just passing out on the streets because they're not wearing the right protection. I'll never forget the time I was in Las Vegas. This is a few years ago. I was in at a conference, and I was wearing shoes. They were crepe shoes. They had very soft soles, so I could walk comfortably and be, you know, walk around these exhibits. You know, those of you that go to trade shows or go to conferences, there's exhibits, and so I wore very comfortable shoes. And I was outside walking around, and I needed to cross the street. And I was standing there waiting for the signal to change, and I noticed that my feet felt weird. Like I was walking, it felt like I was walking on gum. And as I lifted up my shoe, half of my sole was on the pavement, and my shoes were melting. Right before my eyes, my shoes were melting. I was like, what the heck's going on here? Because Vegas has dry heat. Very, very dry heat. And I looked up and I happened to see a thermometer on a billboard. It was 115. I was like, well, it didn't feel that hot, but it was. Here in Northern California, we have insane heat right now. It's humid. It's humid. And that's where it's tough because when the humidities combine and it's 110 degrees and about 95% humidity, that's devastating. That's soaking. That's sucking the moisture out of your body. You got to wear a hat. You got to have, skin protection against the heat. It's insane. My people are from Northern Europe, so we're not used to this. And today I'm looking at the thermometer. It's 90 degrees here in El Sobrante, which is just north of Berkeley. And San Francisco, I just checked. I'm going to be in the city looking at a exhibit. And it is right now, it's 90 degrees in San Francisco. It's supposed to be over 100. And hey, we're not used to this. So I can't say it's global warming simply because there is a air pocket. It's a there's something going on with the atmosphere. It was very, very polluted yesterday. So I think that's capturing the heat and insulating us here. We got a little bit of a bubble, and hopefully the bubble will end soon. Because I don't know. I remember the time I was down in Mexico. Now, this was a mistake I made. It was about 5 years ago. I went in July, and I flew down to Mérida, and it was about 95 degrees every day and about 90% humidity. And I was just cooking. I was burning up. I had to like carry five or six bottles of water in my bag as I was checking out some of the ruins. A friend I was traveling with, we got a ice chest, filled it with ice, filled it with all kinds of liquids and fruits, and had our food in there. It was miserable. I don't do well. So I don't go to Mexico in the summers anymore after that, because I actually got sick. I got the revenge. I was holed up in my, if you guys know what Montezuma's revenge is, that's basically a lower intestine bug. And you can imagine the effects. It's like the worst case of dysentery you could imagine. I'm laughing, but I was in bad shape. I was on tea and water for 24 hours, and I got over it, but I don't wish that on anybody. Anyhow, let's hope the heat passes. I hope you're doing well. We talked last week about summer vacations, and I hope you're getting out and enjoying the summer, have had your vacation. But, you know, there's always time for updates on vacations, for new vacations, and I got one coming up real soon. Hey, this is Cliff. You guys know I'm heading out to the Yucatan Peninsula, and we are down to just a few places left to fill. This is a great opportunity for you to see up close and personal some of the most incredible Mayan ruins in the world. We're going to see Chichen Itza, Uxmal, Ekbalam, Sayil, Labna, and so many more to name. 7 days. Each day we will see an amazing ruin. We'll go to cenotes, to the museums. We will talk, we will meditate, and we will test for the energetics. We'll feel the energetics. Come down and join me. You can see the whole thing on earthancients.com/tours. Check it out. Okay, and we only have 5 spaces left. So, and I've made this really easy to do. It's half the typical price of a tour to Mexico, to Yucatan, which is quite an amazing destination. And we're staying at a 4-star hotel in Mérida, and just a few spaces left. If you haven't had your vacation, come out with me October 28th, November 4th, and every single day, we're going to check out a very, very cool ruin. And the other thing we're going to do is we're going to see a couple of really good museums. Now, the Anthropological Museum in Mérida is noted not only for its collection of figurines found in various tombs and buildings and things like that, but they have some excellent, excellent sculptures. So check it out. Go to earthancients.com/tours, and you can see that. Hey, the article I wrote for Ancient Origins magazine, it's ancientorigins.net, is coming out today, Saturday. They've delayed it. The title is The Rogue Archaeologist, Atlantis, and the Chacmu. This is an important piece. It's part of a book I'm writing called The Maya Controversy. So much we don't know about the Maya, so much that is coming up. And basically, the article is about this sculpture that was found by the rogue archaeologist Augustus Le Pléon. This statue is thought to have been a warrior. Unfortunately, the Aztecs got their hands on it, and during one of the lowest periods in their history, used it to sacrifice tens of thousands of people to the Chacmu. And that was not the design. That was not who that person was. I believe that what we think today is the Chacmu is actually Quetzalcoatl, the deliverer, or as I think, he was probably a teacher of some kind who came back after the Great Deluge. So check that article out. It will be on my Facebook page, Facebook Earth Ancients. Go to the group page. You can go to ancientorigins.com or, hey, just go to earthancients.com and you will see it there. Check it out. Always go to the Facebook page. Tons of stuff there. I mean, just every day we drop tons of stuff there. So that article will be out. And I write an article about once a month for Ancient Origins magazine. Keeps my mind going, and you can get a sense of my interest by reading those articles and the content within each article.
Of all the boys I've known, and I've known some.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Coming to you live from around the world, it's Earth Ancient News.
And there's a tremendous amount that's being reported right now on a new discovery that was made in Italy, an ancient city thought to be on the coast of northeastern Tunisia. The city was called Neapolis, and it's a Roman city, and the scientists have found that they thought it was on the coast. And what has happened is that an ancient historian, a Roman historian, talks about this city, and what is being revealed now is that a tsunami destroyed it, and they found it under the water. And the city is a few thousand years old, and what's fascinating about this is I've talked about tsunamis in Central America. They reported about 2 months ago that tsunamis had crested and fallen into the Yucatan Peninsula, as well as many other portions of the coasts of the Caribbean coast of Mexico. And these tsunamis basically destroyed the cities that were on the outlying coastal area, but actually came in as much as 50 miles. Which means that they were massive, massive tsunamis. But this tsunami, Neapolis, Tunisia area, is submerged, and they have found that the city was basically destroyed. This is big news. It's big news for me because it shows that ancient tsunamis were quite devastating. They're devastating today. We read about them. We see them, in Indonesia. There was a recent one in Indonesia that killed thousands and thousands of people. So, it's amazing. Oh, and by the way, you can read about it on the Facebook page, Facebook Earth Ancients. Go to the group page. I have a video that I put up of an underwater ocean cave off the coast of the Yucatan formed about 12,000 years ago, when the water levels rose after the melting of the ice caps. They've discovered human remains now. They've found part of this cave about 2 years ago, and this is a new video that actually shows the depth of this cave, and they found human remains. They found the remains of a girl and some other bones there. So this water rising may have been quite fast, or this could have been a sacrificed individual, unfortunately. But the video is quite interesting because it shows the depth, probably about 300-400 feet under the land. It shows that that this area was actual land before the water levels rose. So something to consider to check out. Always go to Earth Ancients, and you can see not only this interesting formation, and this is something that they're beginning to look at. Underwater archaeology has been going on quite a bit, but they're really finding some fabulous discoveries, including some partial buildings underwater 12,000 years ago. So always on the Facebook page, video. We have tons of galleries there. Lots to check out. Hey, there's another article that I found, and this is something that you might find interesting. The article talks about our ancestors about 5 or 6,000 years ago. And this is a study on the bone structure of the ancients. Apparently, when cheese and dairy was introduced into our diets, it changed our physical bone structure. And what they've discovered is that our skulls became much thinner after we started eating cheese and dairy products. It changes the shape of the skull, changes the shape of the jaw, and the rest of our upper skeleton, for the simple reason that we weren't chewing grasses and we didn't need to have a mandible or jaw ripping and tearing. And so with cheeses, which, you know, are very easy to eat, I mean, you really don't need even have teeth to chew on cheese. It changes the shape. It changes the shape of our skeleton. So I thought that was quite interesting, a change in showing our anatomy. So Facebook, check it out, Facebook, Earth Ancients. Go to groups and check that out. Also, there's a bunch of galleries this week that I'm not going to talk about. Just go there. Galleries come to us from around the world, and there's something each week new to discover on our Facebook page. So now we check in with our South American correspondent, Ashley Cowie. And each week we see what he's up to. We know there's a number of articles that he comes out with. And you can actually read his articles. The guy's prolific. He writes about one article a week. You can go to Ashley Cowie, Cowie.com, and read his bi-monthly articles. And also information on what he's doing. He's in Colombia, South America. So here's Ash. Hey, so we're back visiting with Ashley Cowie. Ashley's in Colombia, South America. And he has made a fascinating discovery in a part of Scotland. And I want to talk a little bit about this. Hey, Ash, how you doing?
Top of the world. How are you?
Good. So you've made some discoveries of Neolithic, I think you call them micro tools or small tools of some kind. And it's a fairly significant discovery because you actually are saying they're Neolithic, which means they're fairly old, 6,000 years old. What are these tools?
Okay, so what we're looking at are So let me just set this up. Over the last 12 years, I've been field walking in Scotland, which means walking miles, hundreds of miles over fields, looking for man-made artifacts. And I've identified a spot on the northeast coast of Scotland, and I've discovered 44 chert or flint tools, and they're dated to 6,000 years old.
Wow. Okay. And so no one's ever discovered anything. There's nothing around this area. And it's in a place called Caithness, which is what part of Scotland
Caithness.
Is that?
It's Caithness. It's the northeast coast of Scotland.
Okay.
Caithness. And it is, there's a prolific amount of Neolithic settlement sites. Artifacts have been discovered there in the last 150 years. It was like a center point of Neolithic Europe. There are more standing stones and burial cairns in Caithness than there are in the rest of the United Kingdom added together.
Mm.
So, but that nobody finds 44 artifacts. It's called a scatter when you find this, okay? What that indicates is a point of settlement. You know, this isn't like a hunter has dropped an arrowhead out of his bag, or he's been sitting at the campfire, stood up, and a tool's fallen out. This is a site of production, Cliff. That's what's exciting.
Very cool. Now, are you allowed to, when you identify these microliths, as you call them, ancient flint tools, are you allowed to keep them, or do you have to turn them into a local museum, or is there authorities that are kind of the overseers of this Neolithic settlement?
Okay, so I'm going to be straight up with you about that. If I had found four swords on an ancient battlefield and I pulled them out of the ground, washed them and taken them along to a museum, I'm going to get my ass kicked because I've washed off all the pollen from the swords. They can't date them as much because I've cleaned the organic matter. However, I found these tools in the middle of nowhere. If I left them be, they would have got ploughed by the farmer the next ploughing 3 months later, and they would have been gone forever. So do you know what? Legally, I should have left them where they are, contacted an archaeologist, but I didn't. I took them. And I'm going to be presenting them and handing them over to the archaeological community in Scotland in Caithness on the 12th of September. Then it goes mainstream and they can get on with excavating and try to track down the settlement, which I predict is going to be within about 100 meters of where I discovered them.
Wow. Now, are you going to have this on your television show in Scotland? Are you going to talk about these when you get back?
Yeah, we're filming this little story, I believe, for the People's History Show. Might not be for the next season, but certainly for the one after. But I'm going to be putting, we've got some Scottish media coming along, so it will be in the newspapers if you Google it, Neolithic Find Caithness. And also, I'm going to be doing a blog video, maybe a short documentary, 4 or 6 minutes, in a few weeks' time, once I've announced the location and revealed the artifacts, which are super cool, I must say.
Yeah.
I have one which is like 4 centimeters high, Cliff, and it's, I tell you now, it shreds paper. It is as sharp as it was the day it was created 6,000 years ago. It's just the finest little artifact.
That's what I wanted to talk to you about, is these things sound like they're, is it a very hard rock? And then when they ship it?
Flint.
Go ahead.
Let me tell you this. Flint, which I think in America you guys call chert, I don't know if my numbers are right here, but I can tell you now the point is accurate. Mm-hmm. You can sharpen a diamond, say, to 10 molecules sharp. You can sharpen flint, chert, or obsidian to about 5 molecules, double the sharpness, not the resistance, but the sharpness of diamond. So you pick these things up and you can cut your fingers. They are hyper effective. So what I've found is a range of arrowheads at different stages of production. I've found scraper tools, which would have been used when they pinned out an oxen hide and scraped all the meat off it. I've got scraper tools there with nibbles along the edges, which actually show where they've been used.
Wow.
It's quite cool to bend down, pick something up that you know was last touched over 6,000 years ago. That's quite crazy.
That is very cool. Well, I'm going to go ahead and post this. I have a picture of you holding one of these micro flints. And we'll put it on the Facebook page for our readers to check it out, and we'll keep an eye on that. And you, Ashley Cowie, and when you go live, we'll either try to get you on the show and talk a little bit about it just before you go on, or after, and we'll follow up on this fun discovery. Congratulations.
Thank you very much indeed.
All right. We'll catch you next time, man. Thanks.
Yeah. Speak to you soon, okay?
All right. So you can catch Ashley's material, you can catch his material, his articles, I should say, on AshleyCowie, CoWIE.com. He's got a real hectic schedule. He's living in Colombia, South America, but he flies to Scotland to shoot his program. He'll do sections of programs, the People's History Channel, which is very popular in Scotland, but also throughout the UK. And last week, he talked about these sculptures he found on this mountain, and this is a big find, and we're going to talk more about this next week. Apparently, not only are there three faces on the surface of this mountain, but there's also a number of other faces that he's going to have to, that he discovered, but he's going to have to use a drone with a camera to get up in there to show these faces. And apparently they're thousands and thousands of years old. So this is not a minor find. It's a major find that the indigenous people of the area of this Colombian mountain have been talking about for centuries. And so we're going to learn more about this. So, but if you want to read about that and other articles, go to ashleycowie.com or just go to Earth Ancients on Facebook, and we'll have some of his material on the Earth Ancients website also. So now we're checking in with Melissa Tittle, the director of content for Gaia, and we'll see what's up this week in the massive catalog of new releases and information on some of their new material. So here's Melissa.
What's your
So we're back checking with Melissa Tittle on the latest programs being released. And, you know, this week is all things Eric Von Daniken. His book, Astronaut Gods of the Maya, has been re-released. It was released in Germany, I think 4 or 5 years ago, in German. And then they translated it. And Inner Traditions just came out with this new multi-page, over 200 pages of photographs from his travels in Mexico. And this new series that Guy is putting out is called Beyond the Legend with Eric Von Daniken. So, hey, Melissa, how are you?
Good. How are you?
I'm good. So, good. What can you tell me about this? This looks pretty interesting. He examines passages from the Bible. The first series is called Aliens of the Old Testament. So, it sounds kind of cool.
Well, yeah, I mean, here's the thing. Eric Von Daniken is a legend. So what we try to accomplish in this series is to have him really just lay it all out there. Obviously, somebody who's produced the show Ancient Aliens, we all know that series is based on most of his work. But, you know, it's also an interpretation to a new series where here we're kind of letting the man just speak. Like, let's just get into all of his work completely. And
so
that's
just letting it rip.
Just letting it rip. Eric Van Daniken, unedited. It's insane. There's so many swear words in German. It's going to blow your mind. I'm kidding.
Well, hey, you have a kind of an inside track to this because you used to produce Ancient Alien series, right? So you kind of, you must have had his photograph over your desk.
Well, I wouldn't go that far. I mean, that sounds very romantic, but
I think he's going to turn 80.
I had George Clooney over my desk. He has nothing to do with aliens.
Okay. Okay, so this is coming out on the 28th, which is Monday. So it was released. And the second one that I've learned about is Signs of the Gods, which is everything from crop circles to massive petroglyph formations. So that sounds like a very cool series.
I mean, everything, if you enjoy kind of making connections between all these ancient sites and possibly what it could mean, Eric Van Daniken is classic. And this is, again, just more of him and his information. I feel like it's just one of those things, if you're into this stuff, I mean, it's something you can't miss. Not to give you the elevator pitch or anything, but...
No, I hear you.
I feel like most of your fans are familiar with Eric Von Daniken's work, so I don't feel like I have to go into it.
I would think so.
Just like Graham's work, right? You know?
Oh, God. Yeah, totally. Hey, so how's Dave Wilcox's Wisdom Teaching series going? I know you're heavily involved in that.
It's going good.
Is it going good?
Yeah, he's right now he's kind of going through prophecies of different sacred texts and different parts of the world, and and how they all kind of intertwine together to form the same prophecy. And eventually, going through the season, we'll get into kind of how that intertwines with the planetary arrangements in our solar system, which is kind of cool.
Okay.
And so, what's happening going forward in the future.
Cool. So this is called Fiery Birth of a Golden Age, which is it aired on the 28th, which was Monday. So it's just continually a series that just continues, constantly going. So that's great.
It's a gift that keeps giving.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, hey, Melissa, have a great weekend. Thanks for the insight.
You too. And hopefully you have big plans for Labor Day besides watching Eric Van Doniken. Well, that's important.
Yeah, so it's an Eric Van Doniken a mass series of shows. No. Yeah, no. I mean, but we're having a heat wave here in Northern California. It's been like 102 everywhere.
I've heard.
And it's been
heard, even in San Francisco?
San Francisco was like a record yesterday. It was like 98.
Wow.
And I'm across the bay, just north of Berkeley, and it was 102. And my brother, who's out in the valley, he had 111, which is like unheard of. He's in Concord. If those of you listening,
wow,
terrible heat. So we're
right.
Frying.
Yeah, a friend of mine sent their thermometer in their car, and it was 121. That's insane. That's like going to Arizona or to Palm Springs and knowing that you're just going to float in a pool. It's going to be 120 degrees.
That's like shoe melting weather. You know, you go outside and you stand on the sidewalk, and your shoes are melting on the sidewalk. Which isn't fun, because I've had that happen to me. I've worn crepe soles in Vegas one time and my shoes were melting on the sidewalk, and all of a sudden I looked up, it was 115. I'm like, what? I've never been in that kind of heat before. So anyhow,
I miss Los Angeles, but don't miss that. Okay. All right.
Hey, we'll talk to you again.
All right. Sounds good. Thank you.
Okay. Bye. So that's Melissa. The 99-cent special is still available. This allows you all the access you could imagine. Over 8,500 titles and growing every week. And that's why we have Melissa on the program to talk about all these new shows. To get access to this, go to Gaia.com/Earth Ancients and take the change out of your pocket, count out 99 cents, and shoot it through the internet. And start this program. This is a great access point to all these titles, brand new. They have everything from ancient alien topics, all the top people. Melissa is a former producer for Ancient Aliens, now with Gaia. But they also have the history of pyramids, pyramid complexes. They have health. They have wellness. Thousands of titles on specific types of illness. They have yoga, meditation. If you've ever learned about meditation, check it out, because they'll show you how to meditate. So Gaia.com/Earth Ancients. Remember, they sponsor Earth Ancients. And I would appreciate it if you would check them out for the 99 cents a month. Hey, after a month, if you don't like it, jump off. This week we're mixing it up a little bit. I've invited a image analyst, a specialist who recovers data from raw feed supplied by satellites that are orbiting Mars. His work has been featured on a number of websites and TV programs, Facebook, and other social media sites around the world. And I first discovered him with George Haas, who's the director of Cydonia Institute. And so here's our guest today on this segment. So as most of you know, I have a real interest in Mars. I am of the belief that there is standing archaeology There is a tremendous amount of evidence for some civilization, be it thousands or hundreds of thousands, or even, according to some of our guests, millions of years ago. There is tremendous amount of evidence for pyramids, for standing structures, and I've even seen what appears to be Sphinx on the surface of the Mars planet. My guest today is Gary Legere, who is a image specialist. He's an image analyst. His work is noted all over the web, throughout the internet. And he is an expert at recovering data from raw feed supplied by these satellites that are orbiting Mars. And I wanted to get him on the program because he just recently introduced some new photos that are just outstanding. So, hey, Gary, welcome to Earth Ancients. How you doing, man?
Hey, how you doing, Cliff? How you doing, Cliff? Thanks for having me on.
Yeah. Hey, before we get into these images, give us a little background. I think it's good to have you on. You know, I had George Haas speaks really highly of you. A lot of your images come up on his website, which is the Cydonia Institute. And real quickly, what's your fascination? How did you get involved in image refinement on this data that comes back from these satellites?
Well, it started back in 1998, and it was the very day when I got a computer and got online. At the same time, the next day I got a computer, and then that day when I did get online, you know, wow, what do I do with a computer? I barely knew how to type or anything, you know. What do I do, you know, when you're my age way back then, you know, way back then, right? That wasn't that long ago, you know. But it was, that, you know, how many years? 98, 2008, now, oh, my gosh, almost 20 years. I mean, and, you know, not, you know, most, you know, younger people do want to net, you know, they go check out the chicks or they look at art, or if you're an artist, or if you look at construction, yeah. If you're a constructionist, or whatever it was, me, all and all the fun things were looked at, and music, and, you know, looking for movies, wowie. I just said, well, there's something that my buddy that I grew up with, like a brother of mine, Tom Damp, we were in the mall years ago when I was 15, 16 years old at that point, and we were in the bookstore. We were always hanging out at the Sunrise Mall in Long Island, New York, where we grew up, and there was this book on the shelf that caught our attention. You know, it was one of the stores we would go around, you know, look for girls at that day and age. It's a mall thing back then. And what was there was this weird feature, and it happened to be, I believe, Richard Hoagland's book, Monuments of Mars. Only years later did I become aware of that. But we both always remembered the cover, because when we looked at it and we turned that cover over, we just looked at each other, my buddy Tom and me, and we said, that's a face. So, long story short, 1998, next thing, best thing to do. Yeah, it just happened. I did a search for a face on Mars. I wrote a face on Mars, ? In the search. And lo and behold, that day was the day Malin Greybeard gave out the image sweat. I don't know the number right off the top of my head. I have it in the records of what came to be known as the cat box image. You may remember that. The twisted and skewed face, which had so much noise and data, and even, you know, data taken out of it, in my opinion and others. But in which 2001, we got a better image, full head-on view. Remember that? A big sweat and bleed to get that thing. And and even a hit piece with a bump put on it. Do you remember that back then, back in the 2000s? I mean, so it's the face of Mars, basically. So it's destiny. It was destiny. And because I seen it in the image, even that Malin gave out that was skewed, I seen something. And literally, I downloaded the full-size TIFF at the time, and I got me a graphic tablet, and I started tracing all the lines. Just basically seeing where I'm seeing features are going, though some are visible and others are not visible, but you can connect the lines, connect the dots from which the lines I was able to see and I drew out. And the more and more I did this, I had to keep zooming in. Now, these were big images, and I would double enlarge them, not to over-pixelization or anything. We might get touched into that later as being part of the disinformation or the well-wishers or the microscopic alien civilizations. I mean, let's just stick with what we can see by orbital imagery, because that's what originally captured my interest at first. Again, when I was 15, 16, and we seen that that mug on the back of a book and always said, huh. And only years later, my same friend came back into touch with my life. And, you know, it's kind of funny. He's like, it's funny how you were pursued work and dealing with that, the issue of the question when we both looked at each other, that book way back then. And I was like, yeah, no crap, you know, like it's amazing, but it's more like a calling or a destiny, because once I was drawing it out, eventually one day I was walked away from my computer, like a week and a half, no lie, 12 hours a day going over every line. And you can't with a mouse. I had a graphic tablet, which means you have a pen, a drawing pen for a mouse. And it was because I'm an artist as well, like George. And that's another thing with George Haas and I. We've been colleagues and friends for years in this work. And many finds we have looked at and we both agree as artists, we're definitely seeing art. Because I'm not a scientist. I'm not calibered. I'm not educated for these fields. But then again, what schools teach you about how to see alien artifacts or anomalies on Mars, let alone on Earth?
Let's get to the fact here. So you're known as the Mars Revealer because you take specific images that you feel are either unrepresented correctly or perhaps are not photographed quite as well as they could be, and you enhance those. And this new gallery, I had to drop it there because we just go on and on. I'm going to have Gary on for a full program in the near future. His work is outstanding. And what is unique about him is that he takes raw data. And this is why he is probably the number one image specialist for Mars. In fact, his work is even cherished by a lot of professional image analysts who work with satellite feed. But I have a small gallery of Gary's work, and it's on the Facebook page. It's also going to be on earthancients.com. You'll be able to see it. It's a small gallery of some of the newer images he's found. And you know, all of you know that I'm a big fan of ancient Mars. I do believe there is standing archaeology there, buildings, some pyramids, some other features that are not natural. So stay tuned for more from Gary, and we'll have him, as I said, again for a full program with some of the well-known pieces that other authors have featured in their books on their websites. That really highlight this the genius of Gary's work. So stay tuned for that. This week we look at dreams. How our ancestors cultivated dreams, how they used dreams for understanding their livelihoods, how they venerated the gods, and how we use dreams today, and how they're important in our lives. So enjoy this interview. So I think it's important to add a dynamic to our programming here. Most of you who have been listening for a number of months or years, and we do talk about various levels of cognition. We've talked about the meditative state. We've talked about yoga, but we really have not talked about dreams, the importance of dreams, how the ancient people used dreams. And I'm really happy to introduce a new book. The author is Stephen Larson and Tom Verner. Dr. Larson is an ongoing researcher. He is the professor emeritus of psychology at Sunny Ulster, the author of several books, including The Healing Power of Neural Feedback and Joseph Campbell, A Fire in the Mind. This new book is called The Transformational Power of Dreaming, Discovering the Wishes of the Soul. Stephen, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Cliff.
So I have to tell you, I have to ask you, I should say, the book is fantastic. It must have taken quite a bit of time for you and Tom to pull it together. I have to ask you this first question. What was the impetus? Why write a book on dreams? I mean, the book is filled with very important information. You go back into history and then get into the not only your personal journeys, but also those of your patients. Why write a book on dreaming today?
Well, that's a good question to start with, Cliff. I and Tom have each been keeping a dream journal for at least 50 years. That's a formal kind
wow.
of dream journal where you actually delve in and work with the dreams. When I took on this a contract with Inner Traditions, an excellent publisher, by the way, and I'm really happy with the presentation of the book and the way that they helped us put it together. I did an earlier book originally with HarperCollins. No, it was a Viking, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Called The Mythic Imagination. It's now with Inner Traditions. And The Mythic Imagination was the distillation of my work with Joseph Campbell over many years. I knew him personally, studied with him, and Campbell used to say this interesting thing. He would say, a myth is a public dream, and a dream is a private myth.
So, right.
So I decided to, I got a contract back in, I think it was the 1990s, to write a book on the modern myth. And it was originally called Personal Mythology, and then a couple of friends of mine, David Feinstein and Stanley Krippner, beat me by about 3 months with that very title, Personal Mythology. So I and the publisher agreed to change it to The Mythic Imagination, which I think is a good title. And that entire book, Campbell knew about it. In fact, the book is dedicated to him. He said, if you want to tell the modern mythology, a good place to start might be people's dreams, because, a mythology is not an ideology. It springs from the imagination and from the heart, and the way dreams do. And it can't be predicted any more than tonight's dream. So you have to really go into the deeper part of the unconscious to find the mythology. So that's what I did in that book. And the whole book is based on dreams of friends, clients of mine. I'm a psychotherapist. And I also, took some dreams of famous people. I have a lot more dreams of famous people in this new book.
Yes, it's fascinating. Now, your Center for Symbolic Studies is an organization that you and your wife developed. And is that primarily designed to work with people in the dreaming state, or is there multiple types of therapy that goes on there?
I would say it sort of, we thought about doing dreams as the only focus, but mythology is really, it's back and forth between dreams, mythology, creativity, the arts, creative life. My wife, Robin, is an art historian and an exhibiting artist. By the way, my co-author, who I'm sad he won't be able to join me on this program, but I think, Cliff, if you like what we do well enough, you could invite Tom back for another program. He is not only a psychology professor, as I am, and a practicing psychotherapist, he is also a wonderful magician, a stage magician.
Yeah, and I saw that, and... How does that? I mean, he's been doing it for years. That's fascinating.
My wife Robin and I helped him get his not-for-profit started because he does a wonderful, generous thing. He goes all over the world and he teaches magic to kids. And he started with refugee camps in Africa and India, and he goes to places in India where there are compounds with kids who have never really seen a Westerner or talked to them, and he teaches, like, for example, the children of street prostitutes how to do sleight-of-hand magic, which is very useful in India because you can earn a living doing that stuff. You can come up to tourists or other people who are likely to give you a little donation and do some tricks and win their hearts over in that way.
Interesting. Yeah, I will definitely have to get you both together on another program because this book, in the short time we have today, we're only going to get to just a small fragment of it. Let's get into this book. It's very well written. You both combine your knowledge and your practices and your own personal work, which I find just really makes the book real fun to read. You open the book with ancient dreaming, which is a lot of our listeners are very interested in, and you describe how the Egyptians, the Greeks, really cherish their dreams. But can you talk a little bit about how the dreams played an important role in perhaps their daily lives and how they sanctified dreams?
Well, you know, whatever the culture, ancient or modern, it puts its gloss on the mythic imagination or the world of dreaming. And by that I mean to say that whatever the priests or dream interpreters or shamans, whatever their worldview is, that kind of worms its way into their approach to dreaming. So actually, people have been dreaming, as I start by saying in the first chapter, for at least 3 million years. That means as long as Lucy walked the earth, because there's no reason to believe that they weren't dreaming. All warm-blooded creatures and even birds dream. So, unfortunately, we can't ask them about their dreams, but we can ask human beings about their dreams. And with shamans, of course, the shamanic tradition goes back probably 100,000 to maybe 1 million years. The Australian Aboriginals that my friend Robert Lawler writes about so beautifully in Voices of the First Day, they refer to this realm that hovers close to this one as the dreaming or the El Chiringa time. And they bring forth the profound notion that this state that we're in now in so-called modern times, which are supposed to be better and more informed than ancient times, but actually aren't, because human beings have been about the same for that long. They claim that all of our modern experience really harkens back to the dreaming, to the El Chiringa time, and it's a great honor to dream. It's a great honor to be able to transmit your dreams or tell them to other people because it's a font of creativity. From dreaming comes oral tradition, carvings on rock, shrines in the Paleolithic caves 30,000 years ago. Anytime you have a human being creating an artwork which is not a representation of something that appears on the earth to our three-dimensional eyes, you have mythology and you have dreaming implied and represented. So there's an ancient figure of Le Sorcier de les Trois Frères. He's a prancing, mask-wearing, antlered being from the Paleolithic times. That's the only way we could say that we know that they had dreams because we've never found the bones of the guy who's depicted. He's a fanciful creature, and you also have a picture in the in one of the French caves in the Dordogne of a shaman in trance dreaming. He's got a bird-headed staff next to him, and I talk about that in a book called The Shaman's Doorway, my first book written about 30-some years ago, in which I say, hey, what this is about is the flight of the spirit. The shaman is prone on the ground, and he's dreaming his way back into the dream time.
In your book, you actually have a picture of Serapis, who is the god of big dreams. And
yeah.
It's obvious that the Greeks must have, cherished these gods of the big dreams. But I want you to talk a little bit about ancient dream incubation. What is incubation first? And then secondly, these earlier civilizations developed an incubation technique that is different from ours. And maybe it's because perhaps dreams were much more vital in daily life than they are today.
Absolutely, because people thought you might be reading about the immediate future. You might be reading about a enemy culture which is sneaking up on you, or you might be dreaming about an incredible encounter with beings you don't know about. The dreams do forecast the future and tell you things that are otherwise hidden. By the way, that dream papyrus, which is about, I think it's about 4,000 years old, the Egyptians very much believed in demons and in baleful spirits that could bring you bad luck. And so that first dream book is a kind of a, if you dream about this, if you dream about a black dog, it means that there's a wicked entity is coming your way, watch out, and so forth. I don't subscribe to kind of dream dictionaries per se. You might learn something from them, but a dream is a spontaneous living thing. So I went back further than, if you're a Jungian or a depth psychologist, with both Tom and I are, you know about the tradition of Asclepius, the healing god of the ancient world, and he's both a god and a man, so he's a kind of an anthropomorphized being, a so-called son of Apollo, much beloved in the ancient world. So if you see iconography about Asclepius, you're going to see a wonderful, handsome man. Whenever I show him to any of my female students, they say, I think I'm in love with that man. He was much beloved in the ancient world because he brought consolation and advice through dreaming. His sacred animals were the dog, the serpent, and the cock. And, of course, when Socrates is dying, he says, I think it's Meno or Crito, I can't. Make sure you sacrifice a cock to Asclepius for me. So it was, people say, what is mythology? Joe Campbell would say, oh, it's other people's religions. And it could be ancient religions. But these things were taken very seriously when they were the dominant way of thinking. So Asclepius is the god who brings dreams, who heals through dreams. Do the work of C.A. Meyer or Carl Kirenyi, which is very well-known to many depth psychologists. I went back to Peter Kingsley's work in The Dark Places of Wisdom, where he talks about the transition from shamanism to dream incubation is that the person who is seeking either healing or enlightenment in some fashion goes and lies down in a deep place in the earth, like a womb of the earth. And this person was called the Pholarkos, Pholarkos. He's the incubant, and he lies down in a dark place and waits for a dream to come to him. When you do this, when you're not just dreaming willy-nilly like most modern people do, the dreams get very intense, very special, and very sacred, and that's what we call a big dream.
Interesting. So prehistoric and perhaps during some of the earlier periods of our history, you're saying that, and you actually talk about this in the book, about the cave being the incubator in a way, or a place where they could go. And I guess it's a form of sound and stimulus deprivation. Is that what you're suggesting was the early incubation format?
Probably. Anything deep in the earth, the so-called chthonic realm, the Greek deities aren't just sky gods. They live in the earth or in the sea, in the dark places of wisdom, as Peter Kingsley calls it. So that by going into a deep cave, restricting your sensory input, you are more likely to get a deep dream. And the dreams are sent by Demeter or Persephone, her daughter. And Persephone is, according to the myths, a bride of Hades, the brother of Zeus and Poseidon. He lives in the deep places of the earth. And Persephone goes back and forth half the year in the upper world, whereupon the world breaks out in blossom and vegetation, and then down deep into the earth during the winter time, so that, and she's the bride of Hades. And people say, well, that's an awful thing, the bride of Hades. My wife pointed out that it's one of the, Persephone and Hades is one of the longest lasting happy marriages in the ancient world. They're loyal to each other. Persephone or Kore comes back into the upper world, then she goes and hangs out with Poseidon. It's a kind of a, I mean, with Hades, excuse me. It's a sort of a nicely worked out marriage.
Fascinating. There's so much in the book on ancient dreaming, but I want to move quickly to how dreams affect us today in our complex society. And you actually use dreams as, I would say, a form of cognition, how, you know, accessing, reaping the information that you take down. In your own words, what is the importance of dreams in our daily activity? Why is it important? And you've made a career out of this.
Go ahead.
Well, I mean, I'm just curious. Why are dreams so important in today's society?
Because the mythic imagination is timeless. Now, I'll probably, if I'm not talking too much, I'll go back and relive just a little bit of history. If you live in a society that is open to the mythic imagination, open to dreaming, then it's much more likely to present itself to you in clothing that you can relate to or understand. So, for example, a god might appear to you. In the ancient Asclepian sanctuaries, like the one at Epidavros, it would often come in the form of a snake. The snake would crawl on you and deliver a sweet little reptilian dream. Or a dog would come and lie down by you. And the priests, by the way, who presided over these sanctuaries were called therapeutes, the Greek for therapist. That's where the word comes from. And they lay on couches in a sanctuary called an apaton.
Mm-hmm.
So in that special place, these dreams would be really, really powerful. Modern people don't pay very much attention to their dreams unless they are in Jungian analysis or perhaps Freudian analysis. And the difference between them, by the way, is that Freud didn't believe that really you could interpret your own dreams. You had to go to a psychoanalyst who would untangle the Gordian knot of symbols and images that appeared in the dream and tell you what it meant. Jung is a little different in that regard. He says the dream is not hiding from you. The dream is actually speaking a plain language, only we've forgotten how to interpret it or how to work with it. Now, the other part of the question is a psychological question. Evidence has come out, and I think McCarley and Hobson talk about this, that dreaming is not an interruption, let's say, of the waking state. The waking state is an emergence from dreams. In other words, the primary mode is dreaming. And we know that infants spend, you know, half of their 24 hours dreaming and the dream or sleeping, excuse me, and the majority of that time in sleeping is much larger for infants and children than it is for adults. With adults, we typically dream about 2 hours a night and in bursts, often accompanied by rapid eye movements. But you're not going to remember your dreams unless you develop some techniques of waking up right after the dreaming. I made a mistake last night of having a really interesting dream, and I said to myself, oh, I'll just remember it in the morning. I was sleeping kind of deeply, and I didn't want to turn on the light, waken my wife, and all that kind of thing. So I did that. I went to sleep, and I was certain I'd remember it in the morning, and I only remembered a few fragments.
Yeah. I know exactly what you're talking
about. The dream that you do remember is the one that you have right before you wake up.
You go into some good detail about dream remembering, and this is I have the same issue. When I got this book a couple of weeks ago, I thought to myself, I have not been documenting and journaling my dreams, and I find they're really important, and this is the real beauty of your book. Would you mind reading from page 83, my experience in dream remembering? I found that was a really important and interesting statement you made about your dream remembering. Can you find that page?
Okay.
Just read a little bit about that.
If you don't mind me reading rather than speaking spontaneously, here we go. After 50 years or so of keeping a dream journal, I thought I knew everything about remembering and recording dreams. That is to say, until January 2015, I knew this book was due in a year. I set my intention very strongly that this would be the best year of dream recall out of the past 50. I underestimated myself. Usually, I will record more than 50 dreams on a poor year and more than 100 on a good year. In 2015, by setting my intention and doing the due dream diligence, I recorded 233 dreams and in great detail. I charted the usual suspects: family members, friends both living and dead, persons unknown and animals, both natural and strange. And by strange, I mean they're shape-changing animals or mythical beasts. I recorded settings: mountains, deserts, forests, lakes, watercourses such as brooks, rivers, cascades, caves, or vast caverns. If I dreamed of interior spaces in buildings, I noted airplane hangars. I must have been affected, by the way, I'll interject something here, I must have been affected by the predicament of those poor people in Houston, because part of my dream that I did remember just before waking up was a vast sports stadium or hangar, which the roof was leaking. I said, oh, that's not a good sign, the damn roof is leaking. And there were people all over the place trying to get shelter. By the way, that's an interesting point. If you sleep in an unaccustomed place, or if there are unfamiliar noises around you, like if I sleep in New York City or something like that, that's a great way to remember your dreams. It can just wake you right up. You know, the garbage truck comes, and you go, where is that? What is it? And you wake up, and you can record your dreams.
Fascinating.
So I refer here to a gentleman named Gaston Bachelard. He had a wonderful symbolic morphology of elements. I'm reading again now. Fire, earth, water, air, each of them with a mythical or psychological message. I also referred to the rooms in a house, the scary basement, equally scary attic, and the warm and nourishing kitchen, denoting alchemy, for example. The kitchen is where transformation and nourishment takes place. It's very easy to understand. But scary basements and equally scary attics sometimes. Gary Larson, the cartoonist, who is no relative of mine, but I love his sense of humor, this slightly warped sense of humor, and his brother used to lock him in the basement, turn out the lights, his older brother, and go, "Gary, they're coming.
Oh, horrible, horrible.
He didn't specify what it was that was coming. He knew that Gary's imagination would fill in the monsters.
terrible. I'll stop you there because that's kind of the point I wanted to make. Now, I have to ask you that. I mean, after 50 years of keeping a dream journal, you thought you knew everything. I mean, what you set in motion, your intention was to begin populating your consciousness with content for this book in a way. And this is just a wonderful example of your, and I want to ask you, what do you think it is that's helping you, your soul, your subconscious? Who is the driving force of populating your dreams to dream in such detail, in such numbers, for the purpose of writing this book? Or do you think it was just that it was time for this to come out?
I don't know, Cliff. I set my intention. Mm-hmm. I don't think I dreamed any more, but my psyche was sort of like poised on the edge of its seat, ready to capture a dream. And by the way, I promise in the book that I've done a kind of an additional research project, which in fact I am in the midst of right now. Because getting the book out and getting it published took all my time up until now. But what I'm going to be doing is publishing on the internet, on the symbolicstudies.org website. This might take me another couple of weeks, but I'm going to publish a kind of an inventory of the statistical frequency of certain types of dreams. And by the way, there's a later chapter which you might be interested, or your listeners might be interested in, on how you help children with their nightmares or night terrors. And
yes.
I don't know whether you remember the chapter that it was Tom's chapter where he talks about cookie monsters.
Yes, that's very good. Yeah, and how to approach, not to work with the child in asking them, what did they see? Tell me about your experience, rather than saying, oh, don't worry about it, let it go, because the kid just stuffs that. Rather than expresses it. And I think that's the important point that was made in that chapter. So very good.
Yes.
Very, very good.
You don't diminish the reality of what the child experienced. You don't say, oh, don't worry, dear, that's not real, just go back to sleep, or ignore it. No, you say, tell me a little bit about it. What did your monster look like? And what Tom did as a practicing psychotherapist and family therapist is he did a whole day, or it might even have been a weekend, in which the children and their parents were there. They drew their dreams, and if they had scary dreams with monsters chasing them, it's not an uncommon theme for a kid. At the end of the day, they got cookie dough and sort of made shaped their monsters in the cookie dough. And they put icings on it and, you know, red for blood, and gave the creatures fangs, and they put them in the oven. And when they all came out, they ate their monsters.
Which is good. That was great.
And Tom's report on that was that almost everybody who had a nightmare, they went away entirely, or they decreased, and their monsters were like a little chagrined because they realized, oh my God, you know, he could eat me instead of me eating him.
I love that part.
Of course, that's the Sonoy technique that Kilton Stewart brought back from Malaysia. That you have dialogues, and this is a good place to maybe introduce the idea of lucid dreaming, because I have a part of a chapter on that. I'm not in favor of shoving your dreams around, so to speak, or diminishing them in any way. I like to listen to them. I like to let them be natural. But there might be times, let's say, when a monster is chasing you and chasing you too much, where you turn around in your dream. Now, this means you've got a little waking consciousness or lucidity. You turn around and go, okay, I'm getting tired of this. What the hell do you want? Why are you chasing me?
Yes.
And that opens a dialogue, and that's a lucid dream. That's a sort of a Senoi technique. Or if you're dreaming about climbing a vertiginous cliff or a mountain, I'm an old rock climber myself, and of course when I climbed a lot, I would have these dreams of, you know, being on the face of El Cap a couple of thousand feet up without a rope. There are people who are good enough these days, by the way, to do that, to climb without a rope, but I would always scare myself with that. And what the Senoi say is, don't be scared. That's an invitation to fly. So jump into the air, pretend you have a flying squirrel suit on. And there are actually people who do this, by the way, these days. You jump off the rock and you fly. And it's an invitation for you to learn to spread your wings in the dream.
Yes. Now, you talk about the Senoi and their dream work. Now, and that's a different, completely different culture than ours, but you make a good point. When there is something that's frightening or upsetting in the dream, to try to confront it in some aspect, you may have the object or image or something talk, or something will come back and say, hey, you need to do this or that or something, right? Is that what the whole focus of a lucid dream is about, is to get an understanding of what's happening? Is that a good interpretation?
Well, yeah, and as my colleague Tom says, where the fear is, there the power is. In other words, where you have an upwelling of terror, it's a good idea to face it or to somehow take it in, somehow make it your own, confront it, and then you have more power yourself. You get courageous in that in that process.
I wish that we had technology to a degree, because I've had some horrific dreams where someone could kind of be sitting by, you know, when you're in your dream and go, okay, now you need to confront that. Confront it. Because I think in my case, it's like letting the dream run its course without the confrontation. And then you just either repeat the dream or it goes to another phase. You know what I mean? It's a form of evolution, dream evolution, if you could call it that.
Only if you feel like it, Cliff. Just give me a fragment of a dream, one of those horrible dreams.
Lately for me, it's been, being up, I have a real fear of heights. I'm up on the top of Golden Gate Bridge and I can't get down. And so I'm petrified. And then when I was a kid, I would fly. I would just say, okay, I'm just going to fly down. But right now at this stage, I'm like, oh my God, no. So I wake up.
So as a kid, you had wings. Now, as a heavy adult, you're harnessed to your physical body and the literality of what it would be like to fall and hurt yourself. You know, you have to have picked up the pieces of a few fallen climbers to really get horrified about that. But it's a primordial instinct to fear heights. I mean, the actual falling from heights is one of the deepest terrorists that a human being has, because if you literally do it, you literally expose yourself to that. It's death for the most part, or broken bones and that kind of thing. And I think that's one of the fascinating things about rock climbing is, as my fellow climbers used to say, right over your shoulder is that great big electric spook. There you are, 1,000 feet up on a rock wall, and there's all this vertiginous space beneath you, and you're looking down on the forests or the tiny figures of your... And so to do rock climbing safely is to gain power over a primordial fear. And I think people who hang glide or fly airplanes have a similar kind of thing. So I would say, going back to your dream, it's just kind of the inverse of what people have. Very often as a little kid, you're more vulnerable, and so you have worse nightmares. In your case, it's maybe there could be a couple of things in there, and only you can say really what this dream is about, okay?
Right,
so what
yeah.
could be there is both your solidity as an adult tax-paying citizen who walks around on the earth, and if you were to fall, it would be a bad thing. But on the other hand, if you're really high up, you're being invited to take a big, large view of the landscape, and there's a kind of an exaltation inside you that wants to kind of spread its wings, wants to be there for you. And maybe if one of these nights, and you can tell me if you pull this off, there you are on the Golden Gate Bridge or the Chrysler Building or something like that, and you go, oh, here's one of those dreams I talked about. And you just say, oh, okay, let me see what happens. I'm just going to fly.
Wow.
And so there may be a way in which in your life you combine two things. You combine terrestriality and ethereal ability to detach from the earthbound things. And maybe you can fly in your spirit a little bit more.
I'll give that a shot next time. I think the lucid part of the dream has to be effect, not be such a character in the dream, be more of a director of my own dream, which is the whole lucid part of it. So I appreciate that. Look at that. Look
but
at my dream.
If a strong emotion comes up in a dream, that's an invitation to respond in a certain kind of way. I'm not one of these people who... something called the Sonoy Dream Method that Clara Stewart Flagg teaches. I'm not a big one for directing your dreams or taking prerogatives of the dream creator, the creative spirit in the dream. I think we do better if we kind of learn, humble ourselves and learn a little bit. If you control your own dream too much, you're turning into a control freak.
I hear you. So, yeah, let the conscious stream continue. You know, that takes me to the next part of your book, which I found was a wonderful section. And you talk about how dreams can perpetuate success in our lives. And there's a part, and the part that I want to ask you about this is it the soul? Is it the higher self? Is it the subconscious that wants us to succeed? And how does the dream state work in perpetuating success? I thought that was fascinating what you had to say about that.
Well, when you it's a good question. When you, in a sense, marry your mythic imagination or your creative self, it is a little bit like a soul relationship, and you're saying, I acknowledge that there are these other parts to me that are deeper and more ancient than I know about, and I wanna learn from them. I want them to instruct me. It's what Carl Jung called the capital S self, or the creative imagination. We can open ourselves to that and let ourselves kind of learn from that, then you're a deeper and more aware and more resilient person. And the dreams, if you're doing that, by the way, the dreams take notice of the fact that you're a friend of dreaming, and they really respond reciprocally. That's the other part of your very good question a little while ago about how did I catch 233 dreams that year. I was actively, in a sense, kind of making love to my mythic imagination, and it said, all right, buddy, here you go. I had some of the most amazing dreams of my life during that year, and they still continue, actually. They haven't abated.
Wonderful. Wonderful. I have to ask you again, you gave a short description of a big dream for those in prehistory or perhaps early history. What is a big dream for us today in our Western culture? What would that be defined as?
It could be, as I given that, Tom and I given that that chapter there,
mm-hmm.
a dream that pushes the elastic boundaries of the self and shows there's much more to you than this shallow culture ever told you. There's an old friend of ours, Henry Reed, who back in the 60s, I think it was, had a program. It was almost in the very early days of the Internet or before the Internet, called Dream America. What do you think it would be like if our leaders were wise enough to consult their own dreams? That is to say, this country is falling flat on its face, economically, morally, in a thousand different ways, politically, socio-politically. So what would it be like if our leaders listened to their dreams and then maybe worked with a kind of a wise old person, a wizard figure of some kind, and said, you know, what America really needs is not gold toilets. What America really needs is for the people who are advantaged to take notice of the people who are disadvantaged, or something like that. I think we could improve our lot an awful lot by going to our dreams.
Fascinating. I'm going to take a couple more broad strokes here in this book. This book is just packed full of reference material, your own dreams, Tom's dreams, and many of your patients. But can you describe how dreams play a role in precognition, telepathy, and, as you call it, the development of synchronicities? Now, I find that interesting because synchronicities are one of those things that, you know, one thing leads to another, or I met this person at a key time, or I'm writing a book right now. And when I really focus on the topic of the book, it seems like an article will make itself a present to me, or somebody will come into my reality who has some information that solves a problem or answers a question. But how does a dream play a role in those things?
Well, I'd like to look at your book when it comes out. So there are many in your question there, Cliff, and I would say this shows the semi-permeable nature of the soul, and that is to say, when we bend our attention on any given task, and it's probably better if it's a task that benefits other people and a kind of a selfless task, then you sort of provoke the underlying currents of existence. And as Joseph Campbell says, if you quest with sincerity, if you follow your bliss, and he was not talking about bliss in a shallow sense, doors will open for you you didn't even know were there. And he knew about that in his own life because he, every time he would begin working on a book, it's basically the same thing that you just described. He would say, oh, I just discovered this, Arthurian legend that exactly speaks to what I'm thinking about, or I just read the Sanskrit text that Heinrich Zimmer left for me, and he had just the answer I'm looking for. So when the boundaries of the soul are semi-permeable, you could say, you don't want them to be completely permeable, because that's schizophrenia. And as the comedian Lily Tomlin said, why is it when we talk to God, it's called prayer, and when he talks to us, it's called schizophrenia? Joseph Campbell loved that joke. And by the way, Cliff, I'm going to have to, my wife is kind of making stirring sounds in the background. I've got to go to another appointment, but I want to say you
okay.
ask really good questions, and that's a heck of a good question. It's like if we take awareness of everything, of the fact that we are not human animal beings having a spiritual experience, but spiritual beings having a material or an animal experience. That's probably a little bit better way to think about it. If we open ourselves to the deep unconscious, it always takes notice.
Wonderful. My guest today has been Stephen Larson. The book is The Transformational Power of Dreaming, Discovering the Wishes of the Soul. Stephen, how can we read more about your work? Do you have a website? Because I was looking for your website. Do you have one? I know you have one for your center, but do you have one that's kind of a general who's who of you, so to speak?
Yes. Thank you for asking and reminding me. We have the symbolicstudies.org website, and we even have a section in there on dreaming, and we've published some poetry and that kind of thing based on dreaming.
Okay.
I'm going to be lecturing at our therapy center, which is called stonemountaincenter.com. That's the website for that. And that's where I do my biofeedback, neurofeedback, and psychotherapy work, and also some clinical dream analysis. And that is September 16th here in New Paltz at Stone Mountain Center. It's already announced out there. And I'm going to talk about how biofeedback and neurofeedback can help children with night terrors and nightmares. A really profound subject, and parents get very frightened when their kids have night terrors because they can't even tell you what's going on. Neurofeedback puts those night terrors to sleep, or it gives them a content so the kids can talk about it to a therapist or in a sandbox. They can play it out or something like that. And then on October, I believe it's the 15th or 16th, I'm giving a public lecture. It's open to the public at the Stone Mountain Center. It's right near New Paltz, New York. If you go on either website, you'll find a map telling how to get here. It's a free lecture open to the public on the transformational power of dreaming, which is the subject of the book. And then we start a two-day experiential workshop. We start at 10 in the morning and we finish at 6 at night, in which people actually get to present their dreams and work on them and see what's going on there.
Wow.
And that cost for that is $140. Tom also does these dream intensive workshops. Sometimes they last as long as a week, and they're pretty impressive.
Wow, a week. That's a workshop. Stephen, thank you again, and we'll have to have you back with Tom to talk a little more about this book, and maybe we can get into some case studies, and there was more I wanted to ask you, but I understand you're tight for time today. So, hey, thanks for joining me.
You're very welcome, Cliff. It was an enjoyable interview. Thank you.
Okay, you have a great day, and we'll be in touch. Take care.
You too. Bye.
So that was Stephen Larson. If you are interested in dreams, check out his website, and I'll also post information on the Facebook page, and just in general, send me an email, cliff@earthancients.com, if you would like to hear from other specialists who talk about how our ancestors used dreams and how we should be using dreams more today, not only to work with our daily lives, but also prepare more success. This is something I'm discovering, is that dreams can be good tools for precognition, kind of predicting the future, but also using them to set up success. So it's kind of the next step, and it also gets into lucid dreaming. So that was kind of fun. My guest next week is New York best-selling author William Carlson. He has written a book called Jungles of Stone, and it's the story of Frederick Catherwood and John Lloyd Stephens' travels and discoveries of the ancient Mayan civilization. But not just Maya, they went all through Mexico in the early 1800s and found some fascinating buildings that are not around anymore because they've been bulldozed over or have been damaged to the point where they're not really visible anymore. And Carlson really shows the amazing discoveries that these two explorers made. So next week, Jungles of Stone on Earth Ancients. Hey, I hope you have a great day. And get out and do something. Don't sit around. Get out and do something and enjoy what's left of our summer. Hey, because it's ending soon. So, all right, have a great day.